It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. You know, I remember when I wanted my mom to make meatloaf just like my lunch ladies did. I am talking about the days when school lunch was actually cooked at school. So whatever happened to those lunch ladies? And whatever happened to that food? Today, let's face it, school lunch is a battleground. Now, I've heard a lot of arguments, but I think there's a missing link in the discussion. We never hear from the lunch ladies of today. Well, this hour we talk with the chief lunch lady who works the front lines. She feeds over 40,000 kids a year. And then we turn to the family dinner table with Chef Mario Batali. That and much more coming up on The Splendid Table.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and is supported by Lundberg Family Farms, producer of organic rice and rice products, and by the Oregon Bounty Wander Feast, indulging in a new flavor each week. This week, Oregon salutes the cocktail. You can find out about the craft distillery movement, special events, and cocktail recipes at traveloregon.com. Well, we've been thinking a lot about feeding the family and kids now that summer's looser schedules are gone and the homework, practices, and the ferrying the kids around season is upon us. Getting everyone to the table at the same time can feel like Mission Impossible. So how do the busiest of the busy pull it off? Well, to say that Mario Batali is busy is like saying Bill Gates has a little money. The man's running 15 restaurants, a few shops, a vineyard in Italy, and he makes dozens of appearances a year. With all of this, Mario's a dad with young kids and a working mate. So we think he may have a few words to say about wrestling with dinner time in America. Mario, nice to have you with us.
Thank you very much. I'm always happy to be here, Lynn.
Well, you know, this idea of sitting down at the table, you know, everyone's smiling and happy, it's really a great image, but I don't know how realistic it is. Are you ever home for dinner with 15 restaurants?
Well, the lucky thing about having the 10 of my 15 restaurants in New York City or in the suburbs directly outside of them is that between 6 and 7, I pretty much carve out every night to be home for dinner.
That's pretty remarkable.
It is a lucky position to be in, although it doesn't take that much. Once you've kind of committed to the idea and geography isn't the issue, you can always be home for dinner. You just don't have to, you know, settle down and smoke the pipe and watch, you know, Archie Bunker after dinner like we used to do when I was growing up.
Let me ask you, though, how many kids, how old at this point?
I have two boys, 11 and just about 13.
Oh, boy. Oh, you're entering the golden years, as they say.
Exactly.
Well, what's their taste these days in food?
My boys have passed through and into the complete renaissance of trying just about everything, to the point that if you were to ask my youngest what his favorite dish is, he will go for the shock value.
As in?
His favorite dish is duck testicles. And he looks at you with this straight, honest little eyes and says, "That's it. Those are my favorites."
What about the other one?
Benno loves just about everything, is really right now totally fascinated with Vietnamese food. But, you know, at the end of the day, when it comes down to it, my family is very happy with something simple off the grill or spaghetti pomodoro.
You know, your kids must have gone through the picky eater stage. How did you deal with it?
Well, when we had it initially, I remember my boys would eat anything green. They would have plates of broccoli, plates of spinach. But if there was a fleck of green in something red, you would have to take it back and pretend there was a new one coming. And the way we dealt with introducing new ingredients was simply never to bring them up. You know, you would serve calf's liver and you would say, "Would you like some?" And they say, "What's that?" I said, "Calf's liver." And they say, "What's that?" I said, "It's a meat. We've had it before. Would you like some?" And they all always try it. Uh-huh. It never became, "Oh, here we come, Johnny. You're going to give the new dish a try." And if they didn't want it, you didn't even bring it up.
Do you think this business about the family sitting down together, the importance of it, is overblown?
No. I think that if there was a crucial hour in the day where everyone is awake, everyone is aware, and everyone is motivated by hunger in addition to potentially distracted by the eating so that you can often discover kind of hidden things perhaps, I think it's probably the most important hour of communication that a family can have. At breakfast, I can find them a little disarmed by their kind of sleep still in their eyes and can get to the secret inner workings of their brain a little bit. But it's at dinner when they really want to engage that mm-hmm. I think we can find the most kind of payoff. And that's what it really comes down to, direct, real communication. And what I've found to be the most delightful time to have that conversation is kind of slowing the entire planet down a little bit. And after the food is done, while our plates are still in front of us, mm-hmm. not to move quickly on to the next process by clearing. We let the food just sit on the table and make no quick moves to get up. And I think that's where you can really start to add a little value when it doesn't seem that, hey, we're clearing and we're moving on, you know, let next scene or whatever it happens to yeah. be that you say in your house.
Yeah. There's something else that is going on now at the table. It's going on everywhere. Your kids sitting there looking down in their laps as they're tweeting. How does that fly at the Batali household?
That flies like a Led Zeppelin. Nothing like that happens at our house. There's no cell phones. There's no text messages. There's no internet. There's no TV. If the phone does ring, we don't answer it. It's been that way in my family since I was a little kid. Although the word sacred comes up, it's not sacred. It's a respectful issue of how you deal with the people you're sitting with. And there is a sacredness to it, but we don't pretend that it's some vaunted super mm-hmm, thing. Mm-hmm. It's just how you deal with dinner. Dinner is uninterrupted. We have a good time. We're not going to answer the phone. We're not going to answer the door even. So if you come over to my house knocking, you'll wait an hour at 6 o'clock.
All right. Okay. Well, now I know. I'll just bring right. a camp stool.
Or show up at 3 minutes till, because also there is no sacred ring around the table. If someone's there at dinner time, they pull up a chair. And I think it's important in trying to reinforce the importance of the family, also not making it such an exclusionary thing. If your friends happen to be over, hey, there's always room to have a little supper. And if you have a well-stocked pantry, you can extend your dinner with a bowl of spaghetti aglio olio e peperoncino for everybody and cut the protein portion in half. And that makes the whole thing just a little more flexible, a little more likely that everyone's going to make sure they're always around. And if their friends are there, it's like, oh, you know, you're going to have to leave right now. It's more like, hey, let's just sit down and have yeah. supper. In an hour, we'll get back to what we're doing.
You know, I remember a long time ago someone saying to me that much of the world defines what family really is by the people they see around their dinner table.
I agree completely.
Really interesting.
And we allow a lot of people into that dinner table, and such that on Thursday nights when it's fish taco night at our house, people will miraculously be there Thursday at like 6:15 or 6 o'clock and say, oh, it's taco night. I didn't remember. Like, yes, you did. We know you remember.
It was homework
and it's all right.
Night.
Sit down.
Hey, exactly. Mario. Thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thanks
and
for having me, Lynn.
I'll see you Thursday.
You got it.
Goodbye.
Ciao.
You know, I kind of like the idea of fish taco night, don't you? Well, for more information on the work Mario is doing around family suppers and to find a recipe that might gather the whole crew around the table, by the way, it's cheese-gilded linguine with smoky tomatoes, check out the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, do a little exploring. You can find recipes and podcasts and information on our delightful guests and their work. It's all there for you, so take advantage, splendidtable.org. If working has you away from that family table and you're trapped in a hotel, you might think that the only choices you have to get fed are either spending a bundle or doing the fast food route. Well, there is another option, and it is pure genius, and it is on YouTube. The genius in question is British comedian George Egg, and I've got him on the phone. George, welcome.
Hello. Hi.
Okay, George, you have to tell us what you do in a hotel room about food and how you do it.
Well, I'm very much into cooking at home, and as a comedian I find myself staying away from home quite a lot in hotels all over the country. So I stumbled upon this idea of cooking using the things that I find in the hotel room. So the iron, the kettle, even things like the trouser press. I don't know if you get those over in the States, but you get them over here.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, and started out doing quite small-scale things, just ironing some pita bread to cut up and dip in hummus.
Right.
And then getting a little bit more a bit more ambitious and doing slightly more advanced cooking, I suppose.
Well, what you did on YouTube literally had me falling off the chair laughing, but as hungry as can be at the same time. So why don't you briefly walk us through what you did? Because this was no grilled cheese sandwich done with the iron. This was far better.
No, this was a little bit more ambitious.
Yeah.
Well, on the YouTube film, which, if I might say, is the first of a number, which I'm going to upload periodically, so come back again. There'll be more coming up.
Yeah, Jamie Oliver, watch out, right?
Absolutely,
yeah.
Everyone. But yes, in the YouTube one, I cook some tortellini in the kettle, but not just tortellini. I make a sort of creme fraiche and garlic. I suppose it's a sauce, really, but it's not cooked. And then the tortellini is stirred into that. I also put some rocket and spinach into the kettle with the tortellini while it's cooking to wilt that down.
Right.
And then that's all stirred in with a separated egg yolk just to cook through with the heat of the pasta. And it really does make an absolutely delicious sauce. And then also, while that's going on, I've been making some bread dough to make muffins. and that's rising. And then I cut the muffins out and cook those on an upturned iron like one would on a skillet if you weren't in a hotel, if you had the proper facilities.
It looks so delicious. Now, how did you get that bread to rise?
Well, I needed some warmth, and there was a little sort of cupboard thing with a halogen light bulb, down lighter, to light up whatever was in the cupboard. So I got it as high as I could. I needed to use the Gideon Bible to get it as close to the light as possible, but which really, and I dare say, it looks rather appropriate having bread rising on a Gideon Bible under this light, this godlike light shining down on it. I thought that was rather. I must admit, I was rather pleased with that shot in the film.
And so you should be. And then you very gently shaped it into those two little buns and. You cooked it so carefully on that upturned iron. I have to tell you, you have a real hand for this.
Well, I tell you, I really am into cooking. If you're ever over in the UK, give me a call and come and have a meal at my house because I think you'll be impressed, especially with real cooking equipment. It's even better.
You mean like four irons turned on upside down as opposed to just
exactly.
The one? Okay, I've got it. Well, hey, thank you, and we'll be looking for more of these cooking lessons.
Yes, do. There's the next one coming up is going to be pancakes, which is quite exciting because the iron I had there was one of those steam irons that had holes in. So, as you can imagine, that was that was fun.
Oh boy, I can't wait to see what your shirt looked like the next morning. hey, George, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Comedian George Egg's Hotel Cuisine Secrets will be revealed if you go to our website, splendidtable.org. Now, admittedly, George's unusual take on recipes isn't for everyone, but the thing that oozes from George is confidence. I have a friend who's just begun cooking and was really crushed by a recipe that he made that ended up being a disaster. As we were talking about it, I realized that the disaster had nothing to do with my pal's skills, but it had everything to do with the writer's lack of them. He ran into disaster because of a badly written recipe. Well, we started talking about how to tell if a recipe is worth trying. Well, here's sort of the short list. First, short recipes aren't always easier. I mean, they can be like quicksand, waiting to suck you in. So beware of the recipe with very short instructions that doesn't tell you, for instance, what size and what kind of pot to use. Beware of the recipe that doesn't specify how much heat you need and what to look and listen for to know that each step of the recipe is working. Also, forget the recipe that doesn't tell you if you can do it ahead or how long it keeps or what it needs to be stored safely. You want a recipe that holds your hand through every single step, tells you everything you need to know, except maybe to turn on the kitchen light. Okay, coming up, the missing piece in the great quandary over school lunch. We talk with a lunch lady, and the Stearns find the golden rule. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is supported by Just Bear Chicken, all natural with a simple commitment to natural food and respect for both animals and planet. Just Bear Chicken. Go minimal. You can learn more at justbearchicken.com. Well, in the battles for school lunch, that is, to get healthy food into our kids, we've got experts of every stripe weighing in with ideas, but I think we've overlooked a crucial part of this issue. We've not heard from the people on the front lines, as in the lunch lines. We've not heard from the lunch ladies. Now, they're the ones who run school lunch programs, and they wrestle daily with a morass of regulations, tough budgets, and limited time. Jean Ronnie is a lunch lady. She's director of nutrition and commercial services for the St. Paul Public Schools. She's responsible for feeding breakfast, lunch, snacks, and summer meals to over 40,000 children a year. Jean, welcome.
It's wonderful to be here.
From where you stand, what do you see as the main problems in school lunch?
It is such a big question, and I think one with a fairly simple solution, albeit huge in terms of the number of programs that are operated in the United States. I think people would be amazed to find how little money we receive to operate this business. And trust me, it is a business. We work within a school district which has limited resources to begin with, and we certainly cannot be a burden on their budget. Mm-hmm. Therefore, the expectation is at the end of the day, we break even.
Right.
So we get, if a student is eligible for free meals, we receive about $2.68 to $2.70, depending on the part of the country. So we're talking less than $3 for the cost that we have to keep within.
Mm-hmm.
That has to include food, labor, and for us, labor includes benefits, workers' comp, it includes taxes, supplies. We pay for all of our own silverware, all of the paper supplies. We have to buy our own equipment. Then on top of that, we have indirect expenses. We have trucks in St. Paul. We have fuel. We buy the trucks. We pay the fuel. And we have to pay our fair share of the district overhead that is attributable to our program. So we have indirect costs, or what's called chargebacks.
Wait, you're talking about you essentially get less than $3 per student per meal. You've just outlined all of these expenses, and you've not mentioned food.
It is our variable. One of the things that is certainly something that we can't not discuss, and that's the commodity food program. USDA purchases food from farmers, and we get that food to help subsidize our programs.
Right.
And that's about 20 cents per lunch. And USDA decides what commodities, what things are going to buy from farmers, and then in turn we receive those.
Mm-hmm.
If we didn't have that 20 cents to add to our about, on average, about a dollar for lunch.
You mean a dollar for food?
A dollar for food. Yep, absolutely. We in general can spend about a dollar for food. And 20 cents on top of that can be commodity food.
Mm-hmm.
So really, our hands are tied. We have very little bit of money to work with, and we have to make our food dollar stretch like nobody's business. And I think it's really, it's such a mystery that we have folks out there telling us how we ought to run our business without any knowledge of how little we really have to work with.
Yeah.
And that has led to districts needing to purchase processed foods and lesser quality foods in some cases because they don't have the money to operate. There used to be a better funding stream. That got cut back in the 80s. And that's really about the time when processed foods and equipment money became tight and more regulations came on top of what we already had. And we started looking at nutrients. Everything was about nutrients. So we don't have a program that talks about let's offer so many fruits and vegetables anymore
mm-hmm.
and so much milk. We're talking about 30% less calories from fat, saturated fats, vitamins, minerals. All of these things have been added onto the program. So the complexity of the program has been driven to a point where it's just not lunch ladies operating kitchens anymore.
Okay, so we have money and we have nutrition. There are two issues. And those regulations, et cetera, started, I guess, back in the Reagan years in the 80s.
Yes.
What are some of the other things that we parents and consumers should understand that you're dealing with?
Well, I think it's important to know that parents can have a wonderful impact by speaking up about what it is they want for their children. So speak up. Let us know. What can we do? What do you want for your children? Ann Cooper is saying...
Cooper is called the Renegade Lunch Lady.
Yes.
Or she's a professional chef who has done a great deal with lunch programs around the country.
And she, you know, she's very outspoken, as is Alice Waters, who has done some experiments with how do you get kids connected to food. Well, Alice says we need $5 to do school meals correctly.
Per kid, per meal.
Absolutely. Now, Ann Cooper and Slow Food is advocating for another dollar on top of our $2.68.
Mm-hmm.
School Nutrition Association, which has 55,000 members of lunch ladies like me and lunch lady men, they're asking for a mere 35 cents. That 35 cents is just enough money to really bridge the gap between what it costs to prepare a school lunch and what the reimbursement rate is. That's just to equalize the loss. So I think there are enough experts that have weighed in to say we cannot provide the kinds of foods we need to provide our children without money for good quality food.
If you could make this happen, if someone could hand you and every lunch lady across the country, for argument's sake, that extra dollar a child, would this mean sourcing locally or, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables at every meal? What would this be the dream come true?
Well, I would certainly love to see that the dietary guidelines are not politically aligned. The dietary guidelines need to be revamped. Our Congress needs to take action on this issue and come up with sound and reasonable nutrition standards that make sense. Secondly, if we want to go back to less processed foods, higher quality foods, more fruits and vegetables, locally sourced, that requires training. We need to be able to give people the tools to do that,
right,
and do it in a planful way with lunch ladies at the table. I don't want another manual thrown at us. Please, 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 whoever's out there listening, we need lunch ladies at the table saying, this is what we can do. This is how fast we can do it. These are the resources that we need.
Jean, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Lunch Lady Jean Ronnie is Director of Nutrition and Commercial Services for the St. Paul Public Schools. Now, for more information on that district's work, go to the website, splendidtable.org. Jane and Michael Stern always seem to be able to track down a good home-cooked meal. They roam the country unearthing the places that you know exist but rarely find. They tell all on their road food site and here. Jane, Michael, good to have you back.
It's great to be back.
Hi, Lynn.
So what have you been eating?
We have been at a place called Mrs. White's Golden Rule.
I love
that. Isn't
that
a great name?
Yeah, it's a wonderful name.
It's in Phoenix, Arizona, and it's not just an affectation, this name. I mean, one of the many great things about Mrs. White's Golden Rule is that there are no checks given to diners. You eat your meal, go up to the cash register, and discuss with Larry White, that would be Mrs. White's son, what you ate, and he tells you what you owe. And that's all. You never see anything written here.
Mrs. Weiss, we should just explain this a little more, is a little cinder block soul food restaurant near the train tracks in Phoenix.
Uh-huh.
It's been there a long time. And Phoenix, as you probably know, is a place where things come and go very quickly. You know, it's kind of a new lifestyle place. But Mrs. Weiss is one of the few places that has been kind of an anchor for the community for gosh, Michael, do you know how many years?
Many, many.
Uh-huh.
Decades, yeah. And now Mrs. White is no longer here. Larry White runs the place. And not only are there no checks given to diners, there are no menus given to diners either, because what is available to eat that day is written on the wall.
So
it changes.
A menu, just a set menu every day?
Well, you get your choices. I mean, there are like maybe four or five entrees, such as fried chicken, which is great fried chicken, smothered pork chops.
Oh.
When we were last there, he had slabs of barbecue ribs that were as good as Memphis.
I have to tell you, Lynn, with the first time we ate there, we kind of freaked out because I don't know how to say this politely, but I'm not much of a schmoozer. You know, when I eat a meal, I like to just kind of concentrate on what I'm eating. And before we ordered, this man, who happened to be Larry White, but we had no idea who he was,
right,
pulled up a chair and sat at the table with us and commenced into this rather long...
We know all about his married life.
And he knows all about ours.
His business dealings.
Right, who he likes in the community, who he doesn't like in the community. About 25 minutes into the spiel, he said, you hungry? And we said, yes. And then he started singing the praises of his cornbread and sweet stewed tomatoes and banana pudding, and honestly, it was all delicious.
I do have to say also, just parenthetically, lest we forget, that Larry's son opened a restaurant about two or three blocks away that is wildly successful, too successful because he can never get into the place,
mm-hmm,
called Lolo's Chicken and Waffles. And Lolo, the son, makes these really great, like, crunchy, thin waffles topped with great fried chicken and, of course, gravy. And this is a dish that, you know, you never see anywhere outside of a few soul food restaurants in the South and Southwest.
Yeah.
But if you want your meal with a side order of great Southern, you know, gossip and talk, go to Mrs. White's. If you want just food and you don't mind waiting in line a little bit, go to Lolo's.
I would go to both. Thanks, guys.
Okay,
bye, Lynn.
Take care.
Hey, hey,
hey. What's that I smell? Something smelling.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah. We got barbecue smoking, hot sauce soaking to the bone.
Jane and Michael Stern's latest work is 500 Things to Eat Before It's Too Late. Now, their finds are on the site, splendidtable.org. Time to turn to you and your questions. You can find us at 800-537-5252. Anything goes. Mark is calling from Marietta, Georgia. Mark, what do you want to talk about?
Yes, I wanted to talk about foods that are off the table for many Americans. I grew up in a first-generation Italian-American household, and there were quite a number of foods that were very special for me, particularly around certain holidays, that if I told my friends what we ate for Christmas, they would think we were just bizarre creatures. The classic example of that is eels for Christmas. My grandmother would buy live eels. I don't know where she found live eels in the Boston area, but bought her live eels, and she would have them down in a sink down in her basement. She would clean them herself and then grill them on the hibachi on her porch in Medford, and then also braise them in a red sauce. And that was a real important part of our Christmas. She would also make a soup that had bacala, the dried cod,
along
with walnuts, raisins, and celery tops.
Holy cow, in a soup? I'd list
out these ingredients, and my friends would think that those don't go together, and they certainly don't go in a soup. But
they do, They're absent. Bacala with all that wonderful salty, oh yeah. Go on, I'm sorry, I'm interrupting
you. I couldn't agree more with you. These days, the food that I have tried to bring to family and friends, saying, please give it a try, is tripe. And for most Americans, the idea of eating stomach or any internal organ, for that matter, is just nasty. But tripe can be quite light and quite delectable. I've had some delicious tripe in Rome in a very bright, light red sauce with carrots and celery. Mm-hmm. I've had heartier fare in the Boston area at some family restaurants that still serve up tripe. So the question I have for you is, what much maligned foods would you be willing to go to bat for to suggest maybe the average American palate might enjoy, although they might not think they would enjoy?
Well, I'm with you on eel. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is what I would go to bat for. Jowl. The Italian way of curing pork jowl, it's called guanciale. That is just – it is like no other part of the pig. It has a lustiness. I love tongue. Mm-hmm. The French do a fabulous pâté of tongue. Tongue poached in – my mouth is watering again. You lightly poach tongue in broth with – and then what you do is you skin it and you – paper thin, slice it, and you marinate it with vinegar and sugar and garlic, and you serve it on a bed of tart greens, like, you know, curling endive, with a shower of thin slices of red onion that have also been marinated in a sweet sour kind of thing. It is, I mean, tongue can be fabulous. Tongue with balsamic vinegar is wonderful. Tongue in tortillas, it's a great thing from Mexico. Mm-hmm. So that's another thing. Feet. Chinese duck and chicken feet dim sum. I mean, they are, I mean, they're cooked, they're clean, but they're cooked and they're marinated in a sweet, you know, soy sauce sort of marinade, and then they're slowly steamed so that they melt, and it's just wonderful. And also feet in terms of pig's feet, because again, those parts of an animal have a wonderful gelatinous quality, and there's a way that they're served in France where they're cooked in a broth with wine and vinegar, and then they're completely defatted, and the meat is melting off the bone, and you get this hot broth spooned over this, and then you nibble. It's just wonderful.
Sounds very tasty.
Yeah, I'm not so big. I mean, I think selling tripe is a hard sell. I think that we turn up our noses. You know, someone said a long time ago that the world lives on what we put in our garbage pails. And I think to a certain extent it may be true. Yeah,
true.
Because the rest of the world eats every single part of an animal. And we still shy away from that. But anyway, thank you. You've taken me down memory lane here.
Well, happy to do so.
Well, thank you, sir. And you take care.
Thank you.
Bye. You can call us at 800-537-5252. Well, we're going to break away for just a moment to get to our weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question is about pure Americana. It's, what is the translation of Adam and Eve on a raft with Noah's boy? And where does it come from? We're going to be back with that answer and more conversation with you in a moment. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is supported by Lundberg Family Farms, grower of organic and eco-farmed rice and producer of gluten-free rice products. Since 1937, dedicated to caring for the land responsibly and sustainably. More at Lundberg.com. And by Novo Nordisk, since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery services at NovoNordisk-US.com. Now, we're going to be getting back to your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what's the translation of Adam and Eve on a raft with Noah's boy? And where does it come from? Well, the translation is two poached eggs on toast with a side of ham. Ham was the name of Noah's second son. This code comes from what I think of as lunch counter lingo or diner speak. It started back in the 1800s, and if you watch movies from the 30s and 40s, you see it all the time. In diners and luncheonettes, waitstaff and cooks had their own language for orders. So when a waitress called out one order of zeppelins in a fog, she was really asking for sausages in mashed potatoes. When she said one first lady with cow feed, she was asking for spare ribs with a salad. Eve was the first lady, and she came from Adam's rib. Don't you think this is a lot more fun than two whoppers and do you want fries with that? Okay. I am back to your calls. Let's talk. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see. We have got Jeremy calling from Barrie, Vermont. Jeremy, what do you want to talk about?
I'm calling to talk about my wife and I and our cooking experience together. She's a cook by profession.
Uh-huh.
She's very good at what she does. And since we moved in together, I've had trouble getting into the kitchen. She's very, you know, she works for a diner.
Yeah.
She's very good at cooking everything all at once, and she kind of says, oh, sit down, I got this.
My husband has been known to mention this kind of thing on occasion.
Yeah. What I was looking for is I was looking to see if there's any recipes that really should be done with two people, either baking or cooking or something like that.
Ah, that's a great question.
Yeah, I mean, I was watching a TV show, and they were making these things called lobster rolls or something like that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They had to have one person would hold the dough, and the other person was stretching it, and then they would roll it over, and they'd stretch it again. And
yeah.
It looked like a lot of fun, like something I, you know, could do with her, because I enjoy cooking.
Well, you know, it's interesting because you say that, because when you said two people cooking together, the very first thing that came to mind was doing something like filled pastas.
Oh.
Yeah, first of all, you know, the payback is amazing, and most of them you can do ahead and freeze if you're so inclined.
Yep.
But the thing about filled pastas that's kind of fun is that you can sort of set up an assembly line together. First of all, you can make the filling together. One person does the chopping, does all the prepping. The other person is at the stove executing the filling. That's number one. Then one person actually mixes the dough, and then you can choose. You can either roll out the dough with a pasta machine, or you can do it the way I like to do it, which is with a rolling pin. And you can take turns doing that, because you really want to roll that dough out fairly quickly. You don't want it to dry, and you want to get it pretty thin. And you can take turns at that. And then you can let the dough sit for a little while, but you want to cut it and fill it fairly quickly. And this is where having two people is really a dynamite idea. And there's really, you know, there's no big mistakes. The only problem with filled pastas, where they, in quotes, fail, is if they have a tear in them or they're not sealed right. And if you're working with fresh dough, usually just moistening the edges and then really pressing the edges together, you've got a great seal. But the point remains that this is really, the rolling is a team effort, and then setting up a little assembly line, you know, where, let's say you're going to do square ravioli. You have a strip of dough. One of you is going along putting a little bit of filling on one side of the strip, a long row of it separated maybe by an inch or two. And then the other person is right behind them folding over the dough and pressing all around that filling so there are no air pockets and that the edges are sealed. And then you could either just cut between the pillows of dough, or you can use a ravioli cutter, you know, which is, gives it a fancy edge. It's great fun to do. And boy, are you going to have a blast eating it. And you can, you know, the sauce can be as simple as broth and butter, or just, you know, an herb butter, or it can be a little bit of tomato you've cooked down with olive oil.
Oh, that sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, now anything that you do in a dough, spring rolls, you know, egg rolls, dumplings from Asia, any of that kind of thing lends itself to that. Hey, yeah. But I hope it all works out.
Oh, me too, and thank you so much for all your advice.
Hey, Jeremy, thanks for calling. You take care. Call us, 800-537-5252. We've got an email, Denica from Willow Springs, North Carolina. Now, she said she had a wonderful dish in an Italian restaurant. It was called fiocchi, F-I-O-C-C-H-I, and it consisted of little purses of pasta that were stuffed with cheese and pear. Am I familiar with this dish? What type of cheese could be used? Well, this is what I know about fiocchi. It means flakes, okay, the plural, fiocchi, or fiocco can mean a bow. So the little purse came out of that. This is a pasta that is associated with Tuscany. I've also seen it in Lombardy, which is where Milan is. You know, and this is all northern Italy. And what I know it, I've had it two ways. I've had it where it has been done with a puree of really great pear and a very young sheep cheese. you would call it a pecorino, but pecorino in the United States is often like also called Romano. It's an aged, very, very salty sheep cheese. You want a young sheep cheese, which you can sometimes find from local cheesemakers. The other way it's done is with pear and gorgonzola, and either way, it's put into a square or a round of pasta that is essentially sealed up at the top, and it's boiled, and then it can be served a couple of ways. It can be served simply with a sauce of butter and sage and parmigiano, just a little bit of melted butter that you saute sage in. You drizzle that over the pastas, and then you grate a little parmigiano over it. Or you can do it with, if it's done with the mild cheese especially, you can do it with a sauce of chopped walnuts, okay, with parmigiano and a bit of olive oil or a little bit of liquid of, you know, broth or whatever. Utterly, my mouth is watering. Utterly delicious, okay? So that's what it is. You can make it yourself. Very easy to do. You can make them ahead and tuck them in the fridge. Just don't let them touch each other because then they'll turn to mush. So that is fiocchi, lovely little purses to serve. You can reach us 800-537-5252. We've got Anne on the phone calling from Detroit. Anne, what do you want to talk about?
Oh, hi, Lynn. Thanks for taking my call.
You are welcome.
Over the last couple of years, I've been going back to all of the foods that I didn't like as a kid and trying them over again to see if my, you know, my palate's changed and I can sort of bring them back into the culinary fold. And I've rediscovered some great things that I didn't like as a kid, and I think I'm ready to tackle the big one, the, like, bane of my childhood dinners, tomatoes.
You're kidding.
I've never liked tomatoes.
I have. You know what, though? I'm just thinking. By the way, I think what you're doing is just dynamite, but I adore tomatoes. But,
well, I knew you'd be the person who could help with this.
Look, you're talking to a fanatic. I mean, this may take you too far, but, well, what do you want to know, though?
Well, I've been seeing all of these heirloom tomatoes showing up in the farmers markets around here.
Right.
And my problem with tomatoes was the ones that I was exposed to as kids were always, as a kid, were always these sort of pallid, slimy things on sandwiches.
Yeah.
That just even thinking about them kind of grosses me out.
No. I agree with you. I agree with you because they were. They're gelatinous and,
Exactly. And so I'm wondering if there are, you know, more flavorful, less gooey varieties of tomatoes.
No, it's a good question. Okay. So what we're talking about here is tomatoes that are going to make you fall in love with them because they just taste so good.
Yeah.
Now, the heirlooms are generally, not that because, you know, an heirloom isn't automatically good. And the other thing you should know, this is true of all plants. The heirloom that does great in my part of the world may not do wonderfully in your part of the world.
Yeah.
But this is the thing. Generally, the small tomatoes, and some of them are so small, they almost look like berries. Those small tomatoes often have really strong, high acid, high sweet, kicky flavors. And they, I mean, I think they're fabulous. It's the direct opposite of the you know, bland, blah. And I think you wouldn't be, it wouldn't be bad to try the grape-shaped tomatoes. They're sort of oval, but small. Dark, like almost purplish small tomatoes can be a good bet. Very tiny orange ones or red ones, another good bet.
Mm-hmm.
Generally speaking, if a tomato is orange or yellow, it's very sweet and very low in acid. You may or may not like that.
Okay.
But I'd start out with small. Now, you're going to get a fair amount of skin in proportion to center, but that's going to give you a real punch. So start there.
Okay.
And then the only other thing I'd suggest is on the bigger end of it, take a look at, there are green tomatoes that taste exactly like a ripe red tomato. Emerald is in their title. You know, they're medium-sized tomatoes. There's also something called the zebra, the green zebra. Again, a delicious tomato, and it tastes like a red tomato.
I think I've seen those. They're kind of stripey.
Yeah.
A little, yeah.
Yeah, and they're delicious. The brandywine, which is sort of a pinkish color can be really flavorful. And there's actually a tomato called Boxcar Willie. It's a big red bruiser of a tomato. I mean, it looks like that tomato that you saw in the ads in the 1800s, you know. And that can be a delicious tomato.
And these little guys, you would just toss them in a salad or
or just eat them out of hand. One of the things I do is I get a little oil in a pan, really hot, some olive oil, and I throw them in the pan and I squish them with the back of a spatula. I mean, it's a little messy, but oh, you let them almost fry in the oil and then you toss them with pasta. I mean, I throw some garlic and onion in a little later and you toss them with pasta. Not bad at all. So good.
Right. Well, thank you so much.
You take care.
All right, you too. Thank you, Lynn.
Bye, Ann.
Bye.
Call us 800-537-5252 or email us. Go to splendidtable.org. You know, I think we often forget that grocery store staples like crackers and applesauce or even ketchup can, of course, be homemade. Well, with that tenet in mind, food writer Karen Solomon takes on what she deems projects in her book, Jam It, Pickle It, Cure It, and Other Cooking Projects. Hey, Karen, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn. Great to be here.
You know, you take on something that I have to say scares me half to death. You make your own bacon.
Of course. Bacon's fantastic. It's really easy, Lynn.
Yeah, but I must say the safety issues really get to me, and that's what makes me stop.
Well, I mean, there's very little concern for that if you take a couple of precautions. In my recipe for bacon, I definitely call for Instacure, which is a little sodium nitrate mixed with salt. It does have to be special ordered, but it's completely worth it. Because if you're leaving your bacon to cure in your refrigerator about 7 to 10 days, you definitely want to take some precautions.
Right.
I understand. Also, it's certainly not recommended, and I don't think many people would eat any of this stuff raw. So if you're thoroughly cooking your meat, that too is going to prevent any illness.
So explain to me how you do it.
Well, with bacon, you want to get yourself a gorgeous slab of pork belly, and you rub it down with some sugar, some molasses, certainly some salt, and as I mentioned, the Instacure as well, which is a spoilage preventative and also helps the bacon keep its nice pink color.
Right.
And you kind of give that bacon a little spa treatment with a rub down of all that stuff, and you leave it in your fridge, and you flip it every day.
Is it in a bag, or is it in a dish, or what?
Yeah, I like to put it in a giant Ziploc bag, and then put that inside a dish, and just have it in the refrigerator and flip it daily. And then it starts to excrete some moisture, which is a very good thing. It's just part of the curing process.
Right.
And keep flipping it. And then you push on it after, check it after 7 days, but usually it takes about 10. And you kind of see how firm it's getting. And it should feel like well-done meat. You know, if you press the flesh of your thumb when you're making a clenched fist, you know, and it feels really tight. That's exactly what you're looking for in your bacon. And then after that, you add some flavor with smoke, and you can do that either on your grill or you can do that in your oven with some liquid smoke or any combination thereof.
But you're using heat. So essentially, are you, when the bacon is smoking or when you're finishing the bacon, you're cooking it?
It is cooked. It's you definitely want an internal temperature of 150 degrees, which is thoroughly cooking it. And then when you slice it to fry it, or you cut it in chunks for lardons or whatever you like,
right?
You know, you're sort of cooking it again,
because that is the extra insurance policy, right?
Absolutely.
Once it's cured, that it's going to be just fine. Let's talk about making our own lard.
Oh, sure.
How do you do it?
Well, you want to make really good friends with your butcher, first of all, because you're going to be visiting them quite a bit. And also, you want to find the absolute best pork fatback that you can get your hands on. I like to use, you know, quality grass-fed, no antibiotic animals and everything that I make. But I think in lard especially, it's important because the difference is remarkable. And you just take that fat back and you chop it up, add a little bit of water, and you want to use a big heavy cast iron pot.
Right.
You know, something that can really withstand 5 to 6 hours of low temperature, something that's not going to, you know, have it stick too terribly to the bottom. And that's pretty much it. It does not need a whole lot of love and attention after that. You kind of let that the fat and the connective tissue melt down. And the water eventually evaporates. And then you have this rendered fat. And then after the fat has been rendered, you let it cool and you mix it with a little bit of water. You put it in the refrigerator overnight. And then the fat, the beautiful pure white fat, floats to the top and all the debris and water stays at the bottom. And then you just toss that away. And then you have your fat, you melt it down, you put it in a glass jar, and you're ready to cook anything and everything.
Karen, this sounds great. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
Karen Solomon is author of Jam It, Pickle It, Cure It, and Other Cooking Projects. That bacon recipe can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Ogden Nash. It's a poem. The pig, if I am not mistaken, gives us ham and pork and bacon. Let others think his heart is big. I think it stupid of the pig. The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported by the Wall Street Journal Weekend, with 4 sections of ideas, information, advice, and destinations designed to help get more out of the weekend. The Wall Street Journal Weekend is available at newsstands every Saturday. And by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. You can meet people who love food at food.gather.com. You're going to find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. And also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Brett Baldwin. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We're going to be back next week, and you have a good one. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.